welcome to the Upbeat Podcast, the podcast made by conductors. My name is John Devlin, and I am the music director of the Wheeling Symphony Orchestra.
And I'm Enrico Lopez-Yanez, principal pops conductor of the Nashville Symphony. John, it feels like I haven't said those words to you in months, in ages at least. I don't know. It's been too long.
Yeah. To our beloved audience, we are so happy to be back with you, but you will have to forgive us that as COVID left, the schedule's filled up again. And so we are just excited to be back on the mics, and we have a great episode for you and a little bit of a new format. Do you want to tell everybody what we're thinking, Enrico, to make it possible for us to reach everybody again?
Yeah, well, we're still going to try and bring some of your favorite elements to all of these episodes, of course, trying to seek out industry leaders and innovators and people that we think would be great for you to learn about. So you'll hear those classic interviews, John and I kind of trying to figure out the best ways to unlock unique aspects of the conducting world for all of you listeners out there. But in addition, we're going to sort of extend our introductions to you every week. And rather than do our traditional four fours, we're going to sort of freeform it and talk a little bit more about just what has been going on and navigate through how that connects to conducting in general, because we noticed that every time we have a phone conversation, John, that's what it ends up being anyway. Why not just put it on the podcast?
Yeah. And then, you know, for the listeners, you imagine what we go through. We look back at every single previous episode and see what were the topics we covered. And now in season five, this is season five, episode three, which I think I forgot to say at the beginning. We've covered almost every topic where in a vacuum, we would discuss something practical for your career. Like, we struggle to come up with new ones. So instead, what we're going to try to do is see like what is relevant in my and Enrico's stories over the last few weeks or months, dive into the types of conversations that Enrico and I would have as conversations on the phone when we're catching up or asking each other for advice, and then find a way to connect that to the guest of each episode, which we're excited about doing. And we hope that you'll enjoy this new kind of streamlined format, which will make it easier for us to be on your podcast feed more often.
Yeah. And since so much time has passed since our previous recording, we actually have so much to catch up on. I don't know that we're going to be able to cover it all in just this little segment, but we can try. And John, I'm going to start by asking you a little bit about everything that's been going on, because one, there have been some exciting announcements at home orchestra of Wheeling that have been going on. Maybe we can start there, because you guys have been working on some really cool projects, but also you have some pretty cool new team members who you may or may not have stolen away from us here in Nashville.
We are delighted that Sonia Thomes has taken the helm as the executive director at the Wheeling Symphony Orchestra. For a long time, the Wheeling Symphony during the COVID period was transitioning, and it made a search very difficult for a successor to my dear colleague Brian Bronlick when he left for another opportunity. But Sonia has just hit the ground running and is functioning so well. You know, it takes about a month or two for her to get settled and figure out where she's going to get her hair cut and where to take the car and, you know, what the doctor, where you can get your laundry done, and also meet all of these people. There's right. 30 board members, a full staff, all the musicians. But she's done so thoughtfully. She's done so quickly. And immediately people are drawn to her enthusiasm for what the arts can mean for a community like Wheeling, West Virginia, where she has lots of family and cultural ties. And so it's just been such a joy for me to talk to her every day, start planning the future of the symphony, which includes our 95th anniversary next year, where we're going to focus on music from our region and feature our musicians in many creative ways. But so far, we've had a couple of really spectacular concerts opening the season with Sutton Foster, Broadway star. I'm really excited. In 9 days, I'm going to go see her in Sweeney Todd. She's going to star across from Aaron Tveit, who is the original Christian in Moulin Rouge and just one of my favorite singers as well. I saw Josh Groban do the role recently too. That's right. And he was stunning. Yeah, so that was really cool. And then another just concert that I just want to mention that we did was the Violins of Hope project, which the other iteration I saw of that project was in Nashville. That's and right. Sonia was there for that, and I was there with you, and we got to observe that concert. And our friend of the podcast, Michael Ellis Ingram, we've mentioned this on Upbeat once or twice before, found a piece in an archive in Germany that was written by a man who fled the Nazis and moved to West Virginia. So we commissioned the completion and publication of this piano concerto that my dear friend Dominic Cayley premiered with Michael on the podium. And we had Walter Bricht's daughter and granddaughter in the audience with us. And it was one of those truly memorable concerts that also, I mean, it seems like a little bit older news now, but coincided with the horrible attacks that happened in Israel. We were just a week later. So it felt very temporally significant in terms of the way that the world was at that time. So to sit right. and be in a concert hall and hear that music was really, really special. And it was a beautiful and meaningful way to kind of get our season started in the Wheeling Symphony. And, you know, Enrico, I was wondering how you were going to do your introduction today, because you mentioned Nashville, but since we last talked, you have announced a new position at the Detroit Symphony and gotten your tenures off the ground officially at both Pacific and Dallas. So where would you like to start in this exciting kind of cross-country position you find yourself in now?
Sure. Well, yes. First of all, Detroit Symphony did announce this past fall, which was amazing. And I'm very excited to be building off of really what is many years in the making in terms of a relationship with that orchestra. I mean, I've been working with them for about 6 years now. Early on, I was invited to start doing sort of their education series that are streamed online, and sort of built a relationship through that kind of programming, got invited back to start doing community concerts, eventually POPs series programs and things like that. A lot of the stuff that we talk about here on the podcast of like how you build a relationship over time with an orchestra. And this past fall, they announced that starting next season, I'll be their new principal POPs conductor, which I'm looking forward to and extremely excited about. We already had two programs with them earlier this year. I conducted the pop show Latin Fire that we've been taking across the country, as well yeah. as Vanessa Williams in concert with them. And actually that weekend, we also did one of our family concerts, which was the Monster Bash, which is one of our Halloween shows at Symphonica that we take around. So it was a great way to kick off the sort of announcement season and window with them, is have a little bit of everything from a pop show that I had created to a family concert I had created to then working with a guest artist that I had worked with previously here in Nashville. So it was a lot of fun. But Pacific and Dallas, as you mentioned, also officially started now since the naming, and had great weeks with both of them. Did a Music of Star Wars thing to open the season in Pacific, and then worked with Lila Downs, a great Mexican singer-songwriter from Mexico in Dallas. And that was a really fun way to start both of those tenures. And it's, as you know, it's just when you start a new position at an orchestra, similar to what Sonia is going through at Wheeling, you're trying to learn all the people. You're trying to learn a lot about the programming history, about the culture of the institution and the, you know, goals of each organization. And that's one of my favorite parts to me, is that puzzle of piecing together all of the different aspects that go into how you will develop programming over the course of hopefully many, many years with that organization. And so I've started piecing together those puzzles for each of those two locations, and that's been a lot of fun.
What an interesting topic to confront as we kind of figure out this new way we're going to do our conversations here. Culture. From the outside, like as a sports fan, it's like there's 30 teams in the NFL or whatever, 32, and they act differently, right? Each one, although they have to play by the same rules and they have the same salary cap. I'm doubting myself now, but it is 32. They have to figure out how they're going to treat the people that work there, how they're going to approach the way that they view their team, the way they talk about themselves in the public, what they do in the community. And it's always surprising to me now that, you know, I don't do as much guest conducting nearly as you, but I'm starting to be able to do more of that. And you see people work differently. There's a different set of criteria around which you perform your job. There's a different set of expectations. People communicate differently. You get different things in advance, and some things happen differently on site. Isn't it so interesting? Like, talk to me a little bit about how when you started at Nashville, you know, you started in a lower level than principal pops conductor and you grew within that organization. But now that you're coming in at a very high level to these new places, what are some of the differences and what are things that you're noticing that make the job unique in different places?
I mean, some of the differences are very obvious in terms of just the orchestra. I mean, individuals will obviously create a different sound, and every orchestra has its different traditions of how they perform certain styles. Mm-hmm. They have their traditions of the kind of repertoire that they are most comfortable and least comfortable with and things like that. A lot of it is also organizational history of what they are comfortable programming, and where, as a conductor, you come in and feel the need to help guide them or push them in different directions that maybe they haven't explored artistically yet. And another one that is maybe sometimes less obvious, though at the same time might be really obvious, to play into your football metaphor, is the audience or the fans, right? I mean, you can be very close in proximity. Say, look at San Francisco 49er fans compared to Raiders fans in Oakland. I mean, very different culture of those. Did I get that right? Is that a good metaphor? Am I doing a good sports
It's a good metaphor, except the Raiders now play in Las Vegas.
Oh my gosh, but that's so right. Okay, well, they used to be. Oh, darn it.
But they were so mean that they said, get the hell out of here.
I was so close to making a great sports reference, John, and just took that away from me.
And we're coming up to a fateful day, you know, your 49er Super Bowl.
That's right.
But we'll tell that story another time.
So, you know, the audiences have different expectations of what they are used to coming to see. There are different genres of music they like in different cities more than in others. And you, as a conductor, have to learn about that and have to learn about the history and how to build upon that. And that's not to say that there won't be mistakes or we won't program things that sometimes will or won't work, but you just kind of explore mm-hmm. that. And the more audience members you can engage with and meet, the better I think you have in terms of speed at which to catch up in that, which I'm sure, John, you, of course, have been experiencing not only at Wheeling, but you've had guest weeks recently at places like Greenville, and having to learn about that organization when you were going in for an audition week must have taken a lot of that kind of research.
That's a great observation. Yeah, because when I went to Greenville, it was a music director search week, mm-hmm. which is miles differently in terms of the approach that you take to, say, when I went to Louisville and Princeton, two orchestras where I have started to be able to guest frequently, and I know the administrations, I know the players, I have friends there, and I actually have gotten to know the audiences. I mean, I used to work at Princeton, but Louisville, having conducted there four or five times over the last couple of years, you start to understand what they are looking for from you as you steward the organization for that week.
Right.
In Greenville, you are seeing, will this be a culture match? If I were to work here, the staff, the board, administration, the people that work at the hall, the players, is the way that I would want to be as a full-time member of this team? Would I fit in here? Would my style of leadership be appreciated? Or is it needed because they need something right. new and different? Like, these are the types of questions you're answering, and it's a very deep evaluation. Whereas in Princeton, where I guessed in different capacities, and in Louisville, where I focused on family and education and outreach programming, I think it's a little bit of, do you like what I bring, the type of right. program that I bring when I do this? I'm not there trying to get a big job. I just want to be able to fit into your culture and be a good ambassador for your message. And the Louisville Orchestra is one of the orchestras in the country, as I talk about often, that I respect the most. So when I go there, I'm thinking, how would Teddy and how would their team and how does their player group want this to feel, and the impact we want to have on their audience? And so that's a focus. And it's far different than when you are looking for or already have a full-time job at a place where more of your distinctive personality and style is going to make its way into the DNA of the organization.
Right, absolutely. And it's been great to see now over time how you have taken on that role of really showing your personality at Wheeling compared to what you might be able to guest conducting. It was so fun to see all of your recent posts about the Harry Potter program that you guys did. One of the first movies in concert ever, right, that the Wheeling Symphony has done, which was super cool. And how was that experience bringing something truly unique and first time to them? Mm-hmm.
A piece of advice that I often give to younger artists is, find the thing you love the most, which for us is mm-hmm. conducting, and combine it with something you love second most. And for me, the example I point to, therefore, was Gourmet Symphony for a long time. You know, just the idea of chefs and their creativity pairing with. Now I realize, like, you know, what I do in my free time is I love Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and Marvel and these types of story worlds. I know you do too.
Yeah.
the feeling of staring up at the screen and watching this movie, because, you know, something I equate it to is like some people are so in depth in their knowledge for opera. They can be like, you know, in the second act of Tosca, the third aria, when that happened. Right. And I'm like, no, sorry. But with Harry Potter, I do. Like, I know the stories. I've read them, like, I was going to say hundreds, dozens of times. I've watched the movies. I play the video games. I listen to podcasts. Check out Binge Mode. And I'm immersed in that world. So when I'm painting the story with the music to try to make it the most impactful it can be for the audience, I'm on a different planet of joy. And it's so much fun. Now, I know you do a fair amount of, you know, not pops conducting and some movie conducting. What are the feelings that you get in those experiences?
Sometimes it's panic and stress. Other times it's great. You know, I mean, it just really depends on the moment. As you figured out, the movies are a sort of brain melting experience. I mean, you cannot lose focus for an instant.
Not one second.
If you do, the soloist is not adjusting to you. You know, that film is going to keep going and you better find a way to stick with it. Otherwise, you are doomed until maybe there's a break from one cue to the next, but maybe not.
Right.
So it's really exciting. And, you know, obviously it's one of the things that nowadays oftentimes is best attended in terms of audiences. I mean, it's a great way to connect to different people in the community and relive for us as conductors some of our favorite childhood memories, of course, through the movies, like you said, John.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very intense. And it's something that is not typically taught. I mean, there's not many conducting programs, if any, that I know of that are actually actively teaching you how to conduct a film in concert.
Right.
But thankfully, you know, there are people like the Everything Conducting team who are looking out for you.
Shameless
all
plug because, alert.
Shameless plug. We are adding to our seminar this year a new topic that we will be covering. John and I are going to be diving into a little bit about film conducting, because every orchestra is doing it nowadays, and you need to learn quickly, if you are thrown into this situation, how to learn all of that stuff.
Right. If you don't know what 3M2-3 is, or what a streamer is, or a punch, or how to work with a click track, these are the types of things that our whole mission here is to say, you're a good musician and you're a smart person. What should be holding you back is not a lack of information about something you haven't done yet, or an area that other people have lived through where you can help. So we want to just make sure that everybody knows, and if you follow us on social media, you're probably already aware that on May 28th through the 31st of this year, 2024, we'll be back with the Omaha Symphony, the friendly confines of the Holland Center up there. And we cannot wait to host another Everything But the Conducting Summer Seminar here. There's lots of great things that will be similar to previous years, and we're adding a whole bunch of new things. And Enrico, didn't we have fun there last year?
So much fun. And I mean, we covered so many topics. We met so many cool and interesting colleagues, both people who came as participants, people from the musicians in the orchestra to the staff members. This year, we'll be speaking with some other folks on staff and in the orchestra, as well as some other people like a composer. In fact, a Grammy-nominated composer, because that's Adam Schoenberg will be there. He'll be one of our guests at the seminar, and he's beyond just being an incredible, fabulous, living American composer, also a ridiculously nice human being and just so great to talk to. So a lot of, you know, things that you will expect if you've applied or been a part of the seminar last year, and a lot of new elements coming too for those of you who maybe didn't have the time or weren't available for last year's seminar.
Right. And you can also hang out with Grammy nominated conductor Ankush Kumar Behel while you're there.
That's right.
I just got off the phone with him, and he was telling me all his stories about the Grammys, which were just last night, and it was very fun to hear. And looking forward now to the second half of the episode, you are about to introduce me to a dear friend and colleague and collaborator of yours in Cody Fry. Tell us all about Cody.
Oh my gosh. Cody is one of the most talented artists, I think, currently living. And it's just so incredible to, one, hear his music, follow his career, see all the kinds of innovative and interesting things that he's done. He got his start on American Idol. He was a participant in one of the early seasons. And from there, sort of hit major success with singles like I Hear a Symphony and Eleanor Rigby that went on to earn him a Grammy nomination as an incredible, you know, composer, arranger, orchestrator. He kind of does it all. And we first worked together a few years back at the Kennedy Center on one of the declassified concerts that Ben Folds leads. And from there, our friendship and sort of work continued to grow. We've worked together at several cities and different orchestras, from Pacific Symphony, recently, just a couple weeks back, with the Indianapolis Symphony. And he'll be coming out to some of the other orchestras, like Pacific Symphony, again this spring, along with Ben Rector. They have a show together that they built. And Cody just is an incredible writer. He does all of his own orchestrations along with his compositions. And it's such a unique thing, because there are very few artists out there today who are writing pop songs with the orchestra already in mind as they're composing. Mm. And mm-hmm. that brings such a unique and special element. So we are so excited to introduce him to you all, and you'll get a chance to learn more about him and all of his incredible experience and how he relates to pop's concerts with orchestras just after this short break.
Please submit cover letter, resume, links to conducting videos, plus a list of 3 references.
Does that sound familiar, Enrico?
It sure does, John. And if all orchestras want to see the same thing from us, why does it feel like such a slog every time we have to prepare our materials for an audition?
Well, slog no more, my friend. Slog no more. Introducing AI Applications, a lazy conductor's best friend. Simply input the name of the orchestra and city, add 3 random facts from the landing page of the symphony's website, and finally submit a cover letter catchphrase that you use, like great at attracting new audiences. Then our AI algorithm does the rest. Check out this sample cover letter from Enrico's last job application.
Dear fine grouping of analysis members, please accept this attempt for work from Enrico Lopez Yanzi for the position of stick waver genius at the South Springfield Symphony. I am hold great passion for working on new adventures in repertoire and in soliciting the non-olds to your seats. It would be a minor achievement to speak with your group of non-musicians about jobs in your South Springfield. Please call now. Do it now.
Who wouldn't want to talk to the person that submits that letter? Place your order now.
Lazy Laptop Industries shall bear no responsibility for the listing of references who are deceased, decrepit, or otherwise indisposed. Users are responsible for all legal consequences and liability. Welcome back. It is my pleasure now to introduce our special guest for this episode, Cody Fry. Cody Fry is one of the most talented singer, songwriter, composer, arranger, orchestrators out there nowadays, Grammy nominated, and aside from all of that, just an incredibly great human being. I am so excited to welcome Cody Fry to the Upbeat Podcast.
Yay! It's quite the intro.
Thanks for being here. Well, you know, it doesn't do justice to everything that you've accomplished, but I tried to cram it all in there as fast as I could.
I appreciate it.
So Cody, we wanted to kick things off by just taking a look at what a unique way of achieving success you've had as an artist, because you have this way of, one, as your own orchestrator, incorporating the orchestra from the get-go in your musical compositions, which is something that no other pop artists that I'm aware of are doing. Can you talk to us a little bit about what inspired you to go down this musical route?
Yeah. So I grew up in a musical household. My dad, when I was a kid, he was in the music business, writing jingles and doing television commercial music and stuff like that. But as that sort of the jingle business kind of declined as it fell out of style, mm-hmm. he sort of got into orchestrating, which was always his kind of like first passion. And so I kind of come by it honest. I just love the orchestra. I love orchestra music. And, you know, I learn more about classical music every day. But like, I love the orchestra so much, especially film scoring. And so I have that side of myself. But then I also have this guy that loves pop music and loves songwriting and lives in Nashville around a bunch of amazing songwriters. And so I remember I kept those worlds very separate for a long time. So I was kind of doing my songwriting stuff and then doing my media scoring, and they were all very separate. And then one day I just decided, what would happen? You know, why have I not tried combining these things before? And that was resulted in my album Flying, which came out in 2017, which was kind of the first time I had really mixed pop music and orchestral elements.
Mm-hmm. Cody, it's so nice to meet you now for the first time. I've been hearing about you for a long time from my dear friend Enrico. And I'm so interested in, you know, your background. Like you're saying, you combine a love of classical music that was from your family, been in your musical psyche for a long time. And then you have to get on the road and you meet people like me, conductors that you're meeting for the first time. And then a few hours later, you perform with them, right? Can you talk about some of the things that for the young conductors out there that are our listeners, how do people with whom you're collaborating for the first time make you comfortable on stage? What are the types of things you're looking for to have the best experience with somebody as you get to know them on the stage?
Oh, that's a great question. I think, you know, being nice doesn't cost anything. And I think many conductors would just do well to just be a little bit nicer, just generally. And I think that something that's kind of fun about my life is that I fly under the radar a little bit. Like, I'm well known in certain circles, but most people have just no clue who I am. And so a lot of times when I'm walking in with new conductors or new orchestras or whatever, they're kind of looking at me just like, who the heck is this guy? Like, why is he here? What's going on here? And it isn't still until they start playing the music and then seeing the audience that they go, oh no. And it seems that at that point, everyone's attitudes change a little bit. And I just think to myself, man, you could have been like this from the beginning. You know, there's no reason not to be. But I think other than just being nice, I think for conductors specifically, I don't know. I think obviously as a singer and as a songwriter, tempo is just like very finicky for me. Mm. I know my songs super well. And there's not a lot of interpretation I want you to do in terms of tempo because, you know, sure. I'm not singing someone else's music. I'm singing my music. And so it's not so much of an interpretive art as it is a train conductor art, you know, where you're sort of just making sure everyone stays together. Yeah. And with that said, there's tons of places for conductors to be expressive within my music, but I think it's when conductors sort of veer away from the original kind of tempo and purpose of the tune that things get a little weird.
That's really interesting because, you know, most conductors who are focusing on classical, their job is purely or right. primarily interpretive rather yeah, than, right. you know, we can't ask Beethoven what his actual tempo was supposed to be like, or like sing the phrase how you want it done. But you're the artist and the composer and the everything all in yeah. one on stage with us at that same time. Do you find it challenging? Like, have you ever had conflicts on stage with conductors over that topic? And is that something no. that's really challenging to resolve? No. Okay.
No, I've never had arguments or anything. It's everybody has been very like, helpful all the time. And, you know, because everybody wants to make a great show. The only thing that has happened is that, you know, if a conductor hasn't listened to the tune or something like that, they might just start off on the wrong tempo, but we just talk through it and it resolves itself very quickly.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things that we can do as representations to the orchestra of the earnestness with which we want to take these collaborations that, of course, the orchestra, that's not the primary thing they do often, is being like, go for quality, because we're not going to change the phrasing and the tempo and the things like you're saying, Cody, but how beautiful can we make the sound, and how yeah. many of the same types of things that we do when we're playing Brahms can we do to make this the best it can be? And like, that's the type of thing that when the conductor stands up there and is taking it as seriously as the artist, that's when I think the best product comes out, huh?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's really the conductor's job, in my view, is to bring out the best performance in every player, because yeah. the conductor isn't the one making the music. And so right. it's about how are you coaxing the players to just squeeze every ounce of emotion that they can out of whatever phrase they happen to be playing.
I want to touch back on something you mentioned earlier, which was, you know, a lot of people on stage don't necessarily know your music until you've started, but there's that instant reaction, you know, when we've done your show and you open with I Hear a Symphony, that the audience goes crazy the moment you come out. I mean, the moment they recognize the tunes, I mean, they're losing their mind. And we've had a lot of discussions about some of the rigidity that's surrounded by the orchestra and organizations that are putting on this show, because they don't know your music, they don't know the audience. And you have a lot of great ideas about just how concert experience should be for audiences. Can you talk a little bit about some of the areas that you think orchestras could maybe explore changing and moving forward?
Yeah, well, I think everything is kind of moving in the right direction, albeit slowly. But thanks to conductors like you both, I'm sure, I think things just keep getting better and better in terms of loosening up the concert structure, for lack of better terms. I think, you know, as a kid, I just remember being so struck by how stuffy it was every time I went to the orchestra. It just felt so stuffy.
Yeah.
And I that's not a fun concert experience for very many people. Obviously, like, as I get older, now I'm just like, hey, could everybody, like, quiet down so I can just listen? But, like, if you're a young person, you want to go and have a good time. You want to bring your friends. You want to scream at the artist and shout hello and all this stuff. Like, that's what fun is. You want it to be a fun environment. And there can still be listening. And, you know, at my shows, there's moments where you could hear a pin drop. But, like, it's the permission structure, I think, that I, as an artist at the front of the stage, can give to the audience to say, hey, this is a space where it's okay to be loud. It's okay for us to have a little bit of back and forth. And we're all just here to have a good time. And so I try to do that as an artist. And I'm hoping that more and more orchestras will kind of adopt that mentality.
Yeah. Because I've even heard you question some things like intermission. Like, do we have that? Do we, you know, yeah. How can we make the lights and visual aspects of the performance more engaging and things like that? Are there any things that you're hoping to develop or build into that culture as you continue your career and developing shows with orchestras?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm really just enjoying the shows I'm getting to play now, but sure. I think everything can always go further. I think the thing I do like about my shows currently is that it really is focused on the music, you know? Obviously, some orchestras have better lighting setups than others or whatever, but at the end of the day, really people are coming to hear the music, and so that's what we're focused on, instead of kind of like parlor tricks of production, which are fun. Sure. But, you know, I do enjoy that it's people coming to hear the music. But, I'd love to see orchestras push everything further. I'd love to see shows just get more and more exciting visually. Yeah. And I think some of it is starting to happen. Mm-hmm.
It must have been a big task for you to build your own show and imagine the way it could be best, given this background that you had and those experiences you had as a younger person going to the orchestra and feeling perhaps unsatisfied with the way that it was. Could you walk us through just a little bit of the process of like how you chose the songs from your catalog, the pacing of it, those types of things as you made your decisions about how an orchestra show could or should feel?
Yeah. I mean, like Enrico mentioned earlier, I'm lucky that the orchestra is considered usually from the very beginning of my process. So
right.
It's not like I have to add orchestra. So I can look through my catalog and see, okay, which tunes should go where, but it's not about how do I add the orchestra or whatever. But I think that, like, I try to play my most popular songs, which is also kind of something I wish orchestras would understand. I'm just like, dudes, play the hits, man. Like, I remember taking someone to see Holst, and it was like the reason we went is because we wanted to hear Mars. Like, play the hits, man. Like, and then the show was amazing. And so I think some of these more esoteric shows, while they have art value, I'm like, there's a reason that the hits are the hits, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I, you know, I've, obviously some artists whine about having to play their hits all the time. But for me, I feel so grateful that anyone even bothers to care about my music at all. So whatever songs y'all want to hear, I'm down to play. And then, you know, something else that I'm lucky to do, because as a part of my show, I'm playing my original music, which means that I can break it up with music from outside of my own catalog. So for me, I like to kind of take the audience through a journey of my inspirations coming from classical music, coming from film scoring. And so part of my shows. We've done Mars Holst. We've also done Harry Potter music. I do some Debussy as a part of one of my songs. And I try to like incorporate a lot of those influences that I have that are also just perfectly suited for this entity because that's what they were written for. And so I think it's fun to kind of show the audience that. And when you pepper it in like that as a part of the show, it really tells a story. And the songs aren't so kind of out of left field. You know, they're things, they're selections that people would know probably if they know anything about orchestra music. And so then they get to hear them live, which is what most people never do.
Our typical audience, you know, of course, is conductors and musicians. But I wonder, sort of flipping this around, as an artist, what would you say to artists who don't have symphony shows yet, aren't creating their own orchestrations? Like, what is the value add of trying out being in front of an orchestra? Hopefully you've had, I mean, presumably a good experience so far and wanted to do it, you know, but like, why consider having an orchestra show as a pop artist?
I mean, why wouldn't you want the musical experience of being in the same room as 80 other musicians all making the same piece of art at the same time? It's just, there's nothing like it anymore. I think so much of the artist's life right now is just being by yourself on your computer. And so, you know, even if you tour with a band, that's going to be four or five people, and that's a blast. But it's just such a unique cultural entity that exists that is so powerful because it's like the combined forces and creativity and talent of just a huge number of people. And if you're performing with a choir too, that's another 100 folks or whatever. So I just think it's such a cool thing. And of course I think that. I love the orchestra, but I really think there are so many artists whose music could benefit from just well-considered orchestrations. And I do think, having seen more pop shows recently, I feel like the level of orchestration on pop's charts has gone up significantly, even just in the last 5 to 10 years. Seems like there's just so many talented orchestrators now, and artists are more willing to kind of hand the reins to someone who's very talented to make something great.
And Enrico, it occurred to me that Cody's statement, with which I agree, about playing the hits, right? Like, you have to play a certain amount of songs because people know you by those songs. Same thing with orchestras, except we have 450 years of history where there are those hits, right? But the conversation in our industry right now that's being demanded of us is not to play the popular things, but it's to explore new things, make sure that new voices are included, and to make sure that composer is still a method of employment into the future, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a really good conversation here about how orchestras can fit into that model of advancing the art of the living people that are in our field while balancing that with the types of things that people know and want to come to the shows for. Like, I would be so interested to hear your perspective on how orchestras could confront that very important question.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good one, because I obviously love and respect the idea of an arts organization whose sole purpose is to kind of support something that might not have financial viability all on its own. I obviously think that creates cultural value. On the other side of that, I think that it does seem gatekept a little bit. And you're saying, like, I wish composer was still a job. Well, there are hundreds of thousands of composers. They're just not writing for the orchestra anymore.
Exactly.
And so, like, I think that it's sort of unfair to differentiate between a composer who writes for orchestra and a composer who writes bluegrass. I think obviously those are different things, but they're all music, and it's all like a way to make something beautiful. And so I think I would love to see kind of more orchestral organizations partner with people who aren't doing music for orchestra and have found audiences on their own that they can bring along to the orchestra. And the orchestra can like help uplift and kind of like levitate their music with the power of the orchestra in brand new ways. So I think, obviously, like, I want orchestral composers to continue to exist, which they do. They're all doing film music. but like, and yeah, and you know, obviously there's plenty of arguments to be had about capitalism or whatever. I'm not going to get into that here, but like, I do think that, like, in our system right now, like, financial viability is a mark of quality in a lot of ways. Like, if you can figure out how to make it work financially, then I think that should be rewarded by the orchestras as well. And like, just because it's successful financially doesn't mean that it's not art.
And you are on this episode of Upbeat by accident, very close to making some big news about a topic exactly like this, like viability, the types of ways that we get heard, right? We have to talk about this thing that's in the news just very briefly with your song, Things You Said, where it was starting to go viral on TikTok in China. And then almost immediately thereafter, UMG announced that it was ending its relationship, at least the way that it was currently structured, with the platform. Thank you for being on the show and being willing to talk about that, because you'd look in the New York Times and Rolling Stone. This is Upbeat, but we still want to hear from a conductor standpoint, like, what are the types of things you all are facing and how can we help?
We have the same audience as New York Times, John. Don't be so deprecating of our product. Come on.
There may be some crossover between people that run arts organizations and that check out the Times. But I texted Enrico when I woke up the other day. I was like, look.
It's wild. Yeah, it's been a crazy couple of days. I think, I think my spiel on that right now is that I respect what UMG is doing. It's just a very, very bummer circumstance for me specifically, yeah. And a few other folks. I mean, a lot of other folks who have albums coming out in the near term. I think, to address it head on, I think I've always considered TikTok to be a promotional vehicle rather than a money-making vehicle. And so it's never occurred to me that I want to get more money out of TikTok, because that's not even really how I consider the platform. But I could also understand how certain artists would feel exploited by the usages of their music on the platform. And so, I don't know, I'm not anti-UMG or anti-TikTok. I am just pro-artist. And I think the unfortunate truth about this battle between these two multi-billion-dollar corporations is that they're both going to be fine. And in the meantime, there's a lot of artists on the ground who are going to take big hits because of this.
You mentioned the importance of social media as a marketing platform, which I think is absolutely true. And you are a person who I think really has mastered that art. I mean, you have such a fun social media account to follow on every platform. And that's been a big role in your success and getting you to where you are. At the same time, I feel like classical musicians and classical organizations in general are pretty bad at social media.
Yeah.
They have struggled in finding ways to use social media as a way to promote the orchestra themselves, as conductors, as violinists, whatever it may be. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've strategized your use of platforms and maybe some tips for the struggling artists out there trying to have their own voice online?
No, you make it sound like I know what I'm doing on social media.
It sure looks like it.
Yeah, maybe it does look that way. It is not how it is. I would not call myself an expert in any way, but it is something that I care about because I know my fans are there, right? I've cultivated an audience and I want to serve them. I want to like give them little treats throughout the day. I don't know. Right. And I think that's really what it is about for me, which is that like that's where my fans are and I want to feed my fans because they feed me, and my family. So I think for orchestras, and I mean, obviously conductors can use this at an individual level, but on the orchestra level, I think obviously there's some sort of relic-esque obstacles in the form of some strange, in my opinion, union stipulations that won't allow musicians to appear on social media for whatever, that stuff, I think, all needs to be rethought. But it's also just not even just social media. I've had several orchestras over the last year, I won't name them, announce their shows without even telling me that they're announcing them, which maybe that's kind of a holdover from something they're used to, which is that the artists they've hired are not part of their promotional process, or the artists they've brought in are not expected to help promote the show. But I'm here and I want to promote the show. I want my fans to know about it. I want them to be there. And so I just think it's such a bummer when you, as an organization, would just overlook a free opportunity like that for me to help you promote the show. And obviously I will promote it once it's out, but you know, to make a big impact moment on the day of announcement or the day of ticket release or whatever, I would love to help with that. And some orchestras just, they don't even tell me that they're announcing the show. And I have to find out from some fan who's like, I just bought your tickets to wherever. So that's a bummer because yeah. I want to help. So.
Yeah. Well, the last type of question we usually like to ask people to end the interview is, what advice do you have for a conductor who's 20 or 25 years old and is about to try to be a leader in our industry? What is something you hope they keep in mind as they enter an artistic life?
That's a good question. I'll be honest with you. I don't know much about conducting. Like, I have conducted, but I don't know much about it as a profession. So I can't really give very good advice in terms of like how to, how to like make it as a conductor. I don't know. I think it kind of goes back to what I said earlier, which is just like, be a kind person. I think the days of the tyrant conductor are over, long over. I think, especially for younger conductors, like the reason you're going to be brought in is because you're flexible, it's because you're great to work with, it's because the players love you, it's because you can handle any type of music that's thrown at you without complaint. And I think that's the best way to just like do a good job, is to just be kind.
Well, Cody, as always, it is great to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming to our little side portion of the world of podcasting, which is targeting conductors. We really appreciate it.
I love a niche audience, so this is great.
And as always, best of luck in all your upcoming concerts, and can't wait to share the stage with you again soon.
Oh, yes, very soon.
And now, the coda.
So it was so fun to be back on the mic with you, Enrico, and to catch up. And we had a couple conversations around important topics in our introduction. But the most special thing for me was getting a chance to meet Cody, who you've told me about is such a wonderful musician, but you can immediately tell that he's like a gentle person, kind person, and somebody that's really been thoughtful about his approach to being a musician. And that's what I took away so much from the interview.
Yeah, and what I think has brought me closer to Cody is that shared interest, not only in what, you know, we're presenting, the music, but then he's so thoughtful, like you and I are, in spending time thinking about the experience for the audience, thinking about the design of the concert and how flow is going to be felt musically, how in terms of as an audience you're going to be taken on this journey through the different pieces, and what does that mean? Do we have intermission? Do we not? Do we, you know, all the things that he and I have sat around questioning, and that's something that I think has benefited you and I as conductors, and it's great to see that, you know, the artists are thinking about it too, and we should all continue to think about what is it that we institutionally take as, you know, necessary and a requirement for this experience, and where can we actually continue to try things out, experiment, and forge new paths to engage our audiences in a different way.
I agree. And there were two big topics that came up in the interview that I can imagine us talking about more when we have our one-on-one conversations for the Upbeat audience. The first one I kind of brought up during the interview, but it was, what is our responsibility to audiences as far as performing music that is well-known? Because when I go to see a concert by my favorite band, I hate the 4 minutes that they're like, listen to this new thing, even if eventually it may become another one of my favorite songs of theirs. Because when I'm there, having paid, you know, 10 times the amount you pay for the album to be at the concert, I want it to be nostalgic and or sing-along-able because I know the music already. And I've been going to a lot of Broadway recently where some of these shows I've worn out the album, the cast album in advance so that I know it, but when I go in there, and that's one experience. And so, you know, over the last 5 years, of course, you and I are no stranger to programming new music, but are we doing a disservice if we program sort of well-known music in between the new stuff and the classics? Like, I hope we can talk about this more in the future, but do you have like a quick idea about that?
It's such an interesting thing because our industry is constantly pushing the, you know, you have to program new stuff. We have to build new voices. And part of that is true. I mean, you're not going to discover new hits as a classical music goer if an orchestra is not performing it, if they're not recording it and putting it out there. Because unlike a pop artist, you know, a composer can't write a piece for orchestra, go into their basement, record it, all 80 instruments of it, and release it for you to discover this new classic piece. You have to have a full orchestra there for you to experience. So how do we develop new hits? How do we get the next Beethoven 5 if we're not programming new music? But then at the same time, how does that weigh against, you know, we have to get through all this stuff that is not a hit yet to find those gems? It's a real challenge.
Right, because there's like a crystallization that happens with like a 70-year lag in our industry. We're just now starting to understand the voices from the latter half of the 20th century that will join the ranks of the Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and so on and so forth that we know will be around in 300 years on stages, right? Like we know that Copland, we know that Bernstein, we know that John Adams, these types of people are going to last. And we also know the problems with those people being all, you know, white men. So like, these are the types of things that I think as leaders in our industry, you and I are responsible for, along with our colleagues, of being the people that balance this in a very artful way. Because there is still something important about Tchaikovsky 4 being played in Wheeling, West Virginia, because there's a cellist in my youth orchestra that's never heard that piece live. And they must at some point. So I look forward to exploring that with you more. And then the other thing is just the concert format question. Next year at the Wheeling Symphony, we're doing a lot of no intermission concerts. We're doing a lot of audience responsive things. But when Cody talked about, you know, the lights and the production value and the different, he called them parlor tricks, and I get what he means by that. Your organizations do a new concert sometimes every week, ours every month, and we have very little time to build something. Whereas pop shows, as they get ready to go on a tour, they can build something bespoke for this tour that will then happen 71 or 46 times. You have a lot more resources at your disposal than I. When you're building something, how do you go about figuring out what is the value add for these things that are going to cost time and money from your organizations?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are never going to be able to compete production-wise with the arena tours.
Right.
You know, like, we're not going to have Taylor Swift or Beyonce-level production elements. But we are competing with those tours in terms of dollars that our Nashville audience is spending. I mean, people have a set budget that they are willing to spend on entertainment, and the orchestra falls into the exact same category as any other touring artist that comes through our city. So we have to think about those things. But yes, we are very well aware that we cannot compete on certain levels. So, I mean, we try to continue to advance that, and we try to bring in as much, you know, of the technology that's viable and affordable for our space. But the other thing is that our audience expectations are different. I mean, no one's necessarily coming to the Skirmerhorn expecting the orchestra to be coming out of the floor and then lasers and, you know, all these moving gobos and stuff going crazy.
And Ableton knocking out the eighth notes with you, right?
Right. So there is a difference in expectation, but I think we can continue to explore that technology as orchestras and see where we can bring in elements of that production stuff, because there's a reason more and more tours are putting those things into their budget. It's because there is a very, very much a visual component to experiencing a concert. In the orchestra world, we like to pride ourselves, especially in the classical side, it's like, this is an aural experience. Like, you come and you listen. You could close your eyes and have a great experience. But as humans, we take in so much information visually that you can't help but be swayed by what you're seeing on stage. And that can be as little as, like, a grumpy-looking cellist playing Chaik 4, and you are now questioning while you're watching the concert, why does that person look so unhappy while they're playing this music that they're getting paid to do? You know, so there's a visual component that is inescapable.
Right. I mean, if I could change one thing, and happily this thing costs $0.00, it's what you just said. You would never go to a Broadway show or a pop show and see someone giving anything but every ounce of effort they have at every moment. This happens on our stages with orchestral musicians every single concert. There's someone there that doesn't really want to be there, and they show it from the way that they are while they rest to the way they are when they perform something very emotional, and the audience notices it, and it can actually catch your eye and be inescapable. And so I think that that's one thing, and I'm not saying I have the answer to that because it's hard to talk to your players about that type of thing. But that is something that I think matters. And then on the flip side, going back to the lighting and the visuals and stuff, for example, at an organization with the resources that we have, not this season, but the next season, we've commissioned something where we've taken our guest artist budget and instead turned that only to production value. So we're like spending 30 times more on lights and design and bringing in someone very well known to do that in conjunction with one of the pieces that we're playing instead of bringing in a violinist or a pianist or something. I wish I could do both.
Amazing.
But like, I think that that's an interesting way to spend your resources and say, we're going to do this to Britain for C interludes and add the Passacaglia and be like, what a piece that would benefit from experiential behavior in the concert hall from the production side. So I think that that's something that is one possible solution. Is to pick one piece once a year and go all out in that respect.
Right. And, you know, some of these investments could be investments that benefit you more than just once. I mean, we could take that budget, like you said, and invest it in some lighting fixture or rig that is not just for that single performance, but actually expands our capabilities for all future concerts. And, you know, we don't often think about that investment unless it's something that's necessary, like, oh, the speaker system is now 50 years old, we have to, because, you know, there's a short circuit, replace the speakers, or this light is literally no longer moving, and, you know, that's when we then talk about replacing those elements, especially at venues or orchestras that own their hall. I mean, that comes up all the time more than places that are just renting. But that's really unique and a way to think about it. I like that idea of how do we invest stuff that is budgeted for one thing and maybe reallocate it for something in a different area that we wouldn't typically, you know, make that connection between guest artists to production.
Right. Because every so often I want my audience to come into the hall and see something that they didn't expect they would see and to experience something for the first time. And an orchestra doing that during a Masterworks concert, it's been done before. But, you know, we're going to bring in somebody that the name will be very familiar to you. We can't say it out loud yet, but we're going to do something special, and then maybe it works and maybe it doesn't, but we want to do those experiments.
Amazing. I can't wait to hear more about it when your season announces, which is probably not too far off in the distance.
Well, you're going
to
hear about it in 42 seconds when we stop recording and talk off my heart.
But maybe on our next episode, the rest of our audience will be able to hear.
Was that a segue?
It could be fun. It could be. We are so glad to be back on the mics and to have all of you here listening to us once again on Upbeat. We hope you've enjoyed this episode in its new format, and we'll continue to create content. But if you don't like it, let us know too. I mean, we're always open to positive, negative feedback. A lot of times we just get no feedback, and then we just, you know, do our thing and hope that people care. And
I'm having a good time, Enrico.
Me too. Well, you'll hear that and many more things on our next Upbeat.
And now I hear a symphony.